they have to do with a particular mechanism where regimes change. The template is the Reichstag fire of 1933. Pretty much, I think it's fair to say, all modern tyrants know that
15 seconds.
Okay, that they need a moment of fear of terrorism to make a regime change. So in the atmosphere we have now with Mr. Trump, we have to be aware that when something unthinkable happens, despite our fear and grief, what we have to be protesting for is our own rights.
Mm. Professor Timothy Snyder, thanks so much for being with us. Yale historian, author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And that does it for our show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, where today Joe will be taking your calls.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
After an investigation of the treatment of prisoners at the Oregon State Penitentiary, the Oregon Department of Corrections agreed to improve conditions. Yet, 1 year later, prisoners with serious mental illness continue to be held in solitary confinement. Join us on Prison Pipeline, June 5th, to hear the Disability Rights Oregon report, Behind the 11th Door, 1 year later. That's Prison Pipeline at 6:30 p.m.
Yes, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show here on KBOO, 90.7 your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. Abe isn't here. This is Joe alone, 231-8187. And I do want to hear from you, and I'm a little bit excited and a little bit depressed. We put on a benefit led by Chris Hedges. I always have liked his work. He has a very dark view, which unfortunately kind of pretty much matches my own, but he's a much better scholar than I am and has done much more journalism work all over the world. So I honor him a great deal, and I think he's a really good person to have around. Now, having said that, he said some things that I think are really important to emphasize. And what I'm going to do is say a little bit, and then I'm going to open it up for people, anyone who has a reasonably rational point of view who wants to talk about some of these things. It's a little more informal than usual, and I think that's good. So let's start out with the notion that is very important. In fact, the previous show talked about it, which is the issue of a radical inequality. We tend in America to teach our children that everybody's equal and that justice prevails and it's all for the good, and American history is kind of a positive thing. We, of course, ignore the slaughter of the indigenous peoples, both accidental and deliberate. We tend to ignore the reality of the creation of a nation bound up in horrible human slavery. We tend to ignore the fact of the Civil War and what it meant, and of the reaction to that war in the southern part of the United States, which essentially was to install a bondage system that was not based on chains. So all of that is really true, and all of that is really important, and we cannot deny it. Having said that, we are now at a precipice, I think, where the radical inequality, which has increased, not decreased, over the last 50 years, has become something that has left the working class. And by the way, I don't like this thing that the Democrats have been doing, talking about the middle class. No. It's a two-class society. There are people who make a decent living, but they are working people. Most of them do not control. In fact, I think very few of them actually control the means of production, and therefore do not have actual economic power beyond what they are paid by people who do have that power. This is really an important point, but I didn't want to leave it, and I didn't want to ignore it. So what we have is radical inequality. That's number one. Number two, we have a crisis, both manufactured and real, right now, with the Trump administration and with a definite set of lies that are promulgated, not unlike the lies that were taught in Italy by the fascists or the Nazis in Germany. That is really happening, and Americans are really confused. So much misinformation, so much distortion. It's really terrible. One of the worst parts of it, and I've been doing this systematically for a couple of weeks, is to watch local news on television, ordinary television, all of the four major channels locally. And what I see is a tendency to blur down, to make sound positive, and to create more mildness in even the worst events, except for great tragedies, like the terrible murders that took place on the MAX train. All of that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. All of that has made us essentially a people who rely on that news perhaps more dumb than if we didn't even get it. It's very scary, and it's very real, and of course it's very much motivated by desires to have large audiences to whom one can sell whatever crap is around. Okay? So that's just real. And I came out of that to some degree. I spent a couple of years on commercial radio and found it very interesting, shall I say. I liked the money, but it was always a challenge to keep focused on the really important issues. And for example, when the first Gulf War happened, I opposed it. A manager essentially turned to me and said, once the war got underway, he said, well, I suppose now you'll be supporting the war. And I said, no, I'm against the war. I'll be against the war. I was against the Vietnam War. I was against the Panama invasion. And so on. The point is that his expectation was of a very common sort, that you put up a little resistance and then you turn your attention to a kind of quote unquote patriotic support of the nation state. And it becomes very difficult to make that opposition without being labeled or seen as a traitor. And this is what's happening now. I also mentioned May Day a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, where I was very critical of the Black Bloc. And I want to be fair about that, because the one thing I didn't say, which was really important, is that the police had a horrendous totalitarian role in all that. The mayor and the police set up a set of rules where if anybody did anything bad, like threw something or something, that would be an excuse to end the parade. The parade had a permit, and I'm beginning to think maybe permits are a mistake. The parade had a permit, and the police announced two-thirds into the thing that all children, all women, all non-combatants, as it were, have to leave so that presumably the police could get out of their giant vans and club people and fight with the black bloc, which seems to think that you can build a revolution by attacking the workers of the establishment, that is the police. And I was very upset by that. But the important part of that that I didn't deal enough with was the setup where a challenge was issued by the authorities, which would have to inevitably result in some real resistance. And when that resistance inevitably appeared, because I think the black bloc becomes, without intending to be, a kind of stooge justifying violence by the authorities, that authority then is violent, it is heavy, it is hard, it is harsh, it is well-armed, and it is armored. And it essentially broke up a perfectly legitimate event, which had families and labor union people and all kinds of folk united in a very important struggle. And why that's important, and I actually recently had an argument with an old friend about this, why it's important is not just symbolic, not just to say, hey, we don't agree with this, but because it builds spirit, it builds energy, and it makes people see, hey, there's thousands of us. Remember the Women's March, which was huge. It was a moment where everyone there or watching could look around and say, oh, right, Trump is this liar, Trump is this creep, Trump is this fascist, and he's a sexist, and so on. And as a result, people could feel strong. They could take a deep breath and feel like there is a way to oppose. Now, Chris Hedges, in his talking, did not spend a lot of time about what is to be done. He spent more time in describing what is happening. However, one of the things he said more than once is that a movement must be a mass movement. It must have large numbers, and it must use the only available means that it has that's reliable, aside from stations like KABU, which are very important, or Amy Goodman on television and radio. Aside from all that, the most important thing, really, is to build a consciousness of a community, large community, struggling for justice, struggling for peace, struggling for a system that is not racist, that is not sexist, that is not ageist, that is not dissing people who have disabilities and so on. In order to do that, there have to be lots of people in the street often. And I'm beginning to think that it has been a strategic error to decide on parade permits. If you have to be on the sidewalks, hey, let's see how the authorities deal with a couple thousand people on the sidewalk with signs. Let's see how the system deals with people actually carrying out their constitutional rights without a permit process. This is one of the interesting questions of our time. But in order to continue the struggle as a popular struggle, lots of people have to be involved, obviously. And that means that when groups attempt to break things up or will not agree to the discipline of the event, if possible, they have to be physically isolated from the rest, but barring violence and so on, one can separate out those people, particularly when they insist on acting out as disguised folk. Now, this has been a problem in Europe, by the way, for several years. The black bloc is not just an American problem. And it's not just a problem. It's an interesting variant on the struggle itself. The other thing, the most difficult thing, and the thing I came out of a tradition of, because I'm kind of old, is the struggling techniques of the old peace movement, the Ban the Bomb movement, and others, based on the work of Gandhi and later in the United States of Martin Luther King and others, where you look at the fact that you don't have a majoritarian struggle to begin with. Strategically, as well as morally, discipline and nonviolence become absolute and rigid necessities. I got in an argument with the black bloc people, three of them, arguing that their posture, we will fight the police, is absurd. In fact, it's symbolic, you know, black costume, et cetera, symbolic, not real. And consequently, when it gets carried out in the real world, where you throw stuff or whatever, you're going against superior armament and superior power, and in fact, the power of the state. And that direct confrontation could only work in a revolutionary situation. And unfortunately, that is not the case. And it is not particularly moral either. The moral thing to do is to take the position of to do right, to carry out demonstrations and arguments and presentations to the public, not worrying so much about what will happen, but being sure that what you're doing is righteous. And that is the discipline of nonviolence. It's not only a tactic, though. It's also a more moral position. It's very important, and it was very important for the struggle in the South, and it was very important in the struggle to try to end the war in Vietnam. It's the only method that a non-armed large number of people can use in a democracy or quasi-democracy like ours. This is really important to me, and I really wanted to emphasize it. I also wanted to emphasize the importance of reading Chris Hedges. He's very dark. He has a very dark view, all of which, kind of paradoxically, I guess, kind of fits my own ideas. That doesn't mean that I'm some kind of wise guy. I'm not. But, I've come out of a longer experience. I'm getting a little old, as they used to say, long in the tooth, beginning to look around and realize that we are not able to make any kind of advance because we do not have the elements of a true democracy. For example, there is no legitimate communist or socialist party in America that has any opportunity to get anywhere. It's shut out. Both by the system itself, but also by the awareness of most people that that's not going to work. The Democratic Party has shifted from a mildly left liberal stance that was characteristic, for example, of the crisis out of the Great Depression and World War II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and even Harry Truman, and later Kennedy and Johnson. But the fact of the matter is that that Democratic Party shifted to a middle ground and ended up with some good reform politics, but in essence, to be another part of a legitimized establishment, which included the Republicans. Meanwhile, the Republican Party was infused with the money of the 1%, incredibly so, still is, and is willing, as a organizational effort, to support anyone who gains popularity within that community, which gives us a clown. No, that's really true. A clown, Mussolini or Hitler-style guy who lies and who persuades people who are desperate and who are not well-educated because the media itself does not educate well. And it gives that element a great deal of authority. And when you combine that with Russian attempts to distort the electoral process and various other elements of distortion, it is not a democracy. It is no longer a democracy. And in fact, they, that is that ruling class, that 1%, are willing to allow a clown who is not particularly bright, who tells extreme lies, to actually be the president of the United States. And the corruption that follows thereby is enormous, but will probably survive. I can argue very reasonably, it's not necessarily going to happen, but that Trump will survive these scandals, and even if some of his people are under indictment, and in fact will probably get elected in a second term. This is really serious and really dangerous. Already the terms of the relationship between the European countries and the Russians and the United States have shifted. NATO is in serious danger. A lot of its members essentially are governed by dictators, witness Turkey. And in fact, this is a crisis of enormous proportion where we're having actual discussions of nuclear war and so on. It's really important to talk about this. And I'm open to almost anyone. So we're going to go to the phones and we're going to talk with everybody who wants to talk on the air. And I'm going to ask you, please, in the interest of getting as many people on as possible, try to organize your comments. I know that's kind of outrageous, but organize your comments. here's a lesson in English language. Try to lead with the lead. Don't bury it. Do you understand? That's an old term in journalism. Burying the lead, that means the important points. The tradition of journalism, no longer exhibited by journalists, unfortunately, locally or elsewhere, is who, what, where, when, how, and why. So think about that. Try to do that when you talk on the air. You could even use a notepad to help you do it. It's not a requirement, but it's a good idea. Let's go out to the phones. Who do we have? Ted.
Hello.
Ted, are you going to have a talk? Sorry. No, go ahead.
Hi, Joe. I'm concerned. I think your generation and my generation are focused. Somehow we think that our political activity is going to take place in the street, in marches. I like marching. It's fun to see the other people and so on. But it should not be our primary focus. And yes, it worked in a few cases. It worked in South Africa. It worked within India. But it doesn't always work. And I would ask you to keep in mind what happened in the Arab Spring. A bunch of people out in the street, yes, they were successful in throwing out some governments, and then they don't know what to do, and the whole thing collapses. So I want to emphasize that we need to do the hard work now of being citizens, which means going to Democratic Party meetings. Yes, they are awful. These meetings are boring. It's not like being out in the street. It's hard work. It's boring, difficult, all those things. But that's where we need to start making the difference. We need to take over the legislatures. ALEC. We need our own version of ALEC, where we're taking over the legislatures. But let's focus, rather than on how to march better, how to upset the police in the best possible way and so on.
Yeah.
So that just, in the end, that's not going to work. We need to do the hard work of politics, which is going to meetings, taking over elections, and doing it that way.
No, I think your criticism of what I said a minute ago is valid. It is not going to work simply to be in the streets or to have a mass movement, which is what I'm advocating. What has to happen, in essence, is that when there's an opening in the water board or the local school elections or whatever small unpaid positions there are, good people of great courage, need to run for those positions, need to fill up the bottom of the Democratic Party or whatever nonpartisan race there is, fill it up with people who will work toward larger goals, always putting forward the issues that are important to people in the community at the time. So I agree with you to a great extent.
Well, we need a mass movement. We do need a mass movement. We need a movement of people who start being citizens, who devote an evening a month to go to a meeting and start participating in politics. We really need that, and it needs to be everybody participating. It's messy and it's hard, but to call yourself a citizen when you're not doing that is just a joke.
No, and I think you're suggesting a very reasonable and even easy thing to do. I think once a month is a reasonable donation, and a very small donation, really. And the other thing I would add is you have to support with what little money you have, or as much money as you have, all of the good environmental and egalitarian movements that are in struggle. I'm going to let you go give other people a chance, but I thank you very much for the call. Okay, who do we have next?
Hello.
Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
You guys in Democracy Now, wow. Just want to support what the previous caller just talked about.
Good,
that's
great.
Pretty much, yeah, that just sums it up. And then the other thing is the news media. Unfortunately, after 7 o'clock locally, all the stations, broadcast stations, go to national New York Today shows or whatever, and all we have left is the Fox affiliate. Well, their underlying blurb about the murderous extremist, white supremacist, mentally ill dude that kill people, slash their throats on the train.
Yes, that was a great tragedy on a lot of levels. We can talk about that a little bit later, but it's
very sad.
It's very sad and very difficult.
I'm talking about the coverage, and Fox,
okay,
of course, makes it even more difficult because their blurb underneath, the written blurb that goes by, said he'll be charged with attempted murder and other charges.
It's characterized not unreasonably as a hate crime. So that's another charge.
Well, I've seen other news agencies say what it is, hate crimes.
Yeah.
But Fox said other crimes.
Oh, I missed Fox.
It's so this vague.
Yeah.
I check the weather and traffic, like we all kind of need to.
Yeah.
But all we have left after 7 around here is Fox. So I usually go online to KJON or whatever.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for making the point. I think it is important to understand the media is controlled by other people than us. And that's, by the way, just a little blurb of support. That's why KBOO is so important.
Oh, my gosh.
You know,
we've been an owner member for over 20 years. Thank goodness for them. And I know other areas in the world have media literacy much more than the U.S. It's kind of like the wild, wild west here. And it's becoming worse and worse. And thank you so much for that guest, Democracy Now! Guest about the 20 steps to identify and combat authoritarianism,
yeah,
and tyranny.
Sure.
Wow, so beautiful. Thank you. Bye.
All right, thank you a lot. Who do we have next? Michael, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
So, if you want to build a mass movement, there's something that at the moment the left does that kind of works against that, which is, I'm a believer in the phrase, my country, right or wrong. And I don't mean
by
that.
What do you mean by that? Yeah. What do you mean by that?
And I don't mean by that that the United States never did anything wrong. For me, it's like my family, right or wrong. I mean, someone in my family might do something bad, and I might acknowledge that it's bad, but they're still my family.
Okay. How bad? I just want to get clear on this. If they rape people, if they murder people, still your family, right or wrong?
They're still my family. I have a different feeling. I mean, I might feel more anger towards a member of my family that did something like that than I would towards someone that wasn't a member of my family.
Okay.
They're still my family. This country is my country. I get really irritated when people only are willing to talk about everything bad the country did. They don't acknowledge anything good the country does. They say, well, what we like about America is what it could be, meaning, well, we don't like what it is. You know, it's like...
So, wait a minute. Michael, I just want to be clear. Are you sort of pitching a populist, patriotic line about the nation?
I'm saying that I think most people in the country have a patriotic, positive feeling towards the country, even though it's not perfect. And this punitive attitude that if you're not perfect, we hate you. Most people won't buy that, and the left is guilty of this. The left is like, we hate this country. Everything about this country is bad. The only thing good about this country is what it might someday become, but right now it's evil and it sucks and we hate it. I mean, that is not going to build a mass movement.
Okay, we have a lot of people online. I think your point was well made. I don't agree with you, but we'll talk about it. I think a lot of other people will want to carry that conversation on, so I'm going to let you go.
Bye.
Okay, next.
Juan, Joe?
How are you?
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Listen, somebody on Facebook posted that the guy that did the stabbing on the train on Friday was a big Bernie Sanders supporter. Okay? And the only reason I bring this up is a guy previously, Michael, just said the left hates the United States.
Yeah.
It's like, one person does one thing, and it gets attributed to the whole group. It's like the Black Bloc in these marches, right? The Black Bloc does something dumb, and the entire march gets discredited.
Okay.
Enough of their game.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point. We're going to have more discussion. The reason why I'm rushing people, particularly now, is we have a lot of callers, and I want to get as many in as possible. So, thank you.
Well, I got one other thing.
Okay. Okay.
So, the Democratic Party, if you just watched what happened in California, progressives won the vote and got nothing. They got a guy to run the California Democratic Party who had just taken $100,000 from the pharmaceutical industry to kill the bill that, well, not the bill, but they have something on the ballot to lower prescription drug prices in California. And this guy, a lobbyist, just like the head of the DNC, a lobbyist, took $100,000 to work against this.
Okay.
So how do we take over the Democratic Party when the system is rigged? They have to get through the filter to be a candidate, you got to have the right attitude, which is work for the money, and all the superdelegates and all the sheeple. All right?
You have to have
100% of the base voting for the progressive candidate to get past the superdelegates.
It is indeed a difficult process. No one says that it's easy.
They've made it impossible, Joe, and they did it after George McGovern.
Okay, we'll discuss whether it's impossible or not. It's difficult, and I agree with your analysis that it is difficult. But I'm going to let you go, and we want to go to some other people. I want to make a quick comment on all of that. What I said earlier is really important. People, ordinary people, with ideas that are their ideas and authentic ideas born out of knowledge, hopefully, should be running for all of the offices that in every local election that don't pay, that cannot be a job, that cannot be a career, and should be getting those posts and should be building constituencies within the context of those jobs. The school systems, the water systems, the whatever there is that's available that's an electoral office. Because those are not yet dominated and cannot be dominated by the Democrats or the Republicans, particularly in a state like this. Now, are we up against vast money? Is it an extremely difficult problem? Is it highly problematic? Yeah. But the only answer, the only response that you can make to power is to speak truth. It's an existential dilemma. If you had said to somebody in 1952 or 3 or something like that, the South will never have any kind of equality, black people will never get to vote, and so on. Or if you'd said in the 1920s, well, you know, they smashed the left and organized labor will never get anywhere. Any of those assumptions would have been proven wrong by the action of organized efforts. And you can't know the outcome. You can't know when that turning point will come. All you can do is place your faith, serious faith, in the possibility and in the ability of people to learn and the willingness to teach and talk and exchange. That's all you can do. Otherwise, what you're doing, I mean, I remember people during the Vietnam War era who were so upset that they were buying AK-47s and M1 rifles and so on and talking revolution. Well, huh, what? And that ended up with the Weather Underground and a lot of other things that in the end simply galvanized the public to support the establishment. And I think we really need, whatever we're doing, a sense of discipline that involves nonviolence. It's the only weapon we have, ironically. That's my position. Let's hear from some of you. 231-8187. Who do we got?
We have George.
George?
Hi, good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
Did you hear the interview with, I think, Steve Early yesterday about Richmond, California, and how they managed to overcome an enormous amount of, Exxon or, you know...
Well, the oil industry, basically, yeah.
And what I remember of Steve Early, I think, who wrote this book, Refinery Town, about this struggle, which ended up with the people of Richmond beating the... oil industry 2-1 in an election where the oil industry outspent them by I don't know how much, maybe 100-1. One of the things I think Steve Early said was they had to get organized, and it wasn't just a once a month thing, it was every day of the year they had to have people out knocking on the doors, talking to people, organizing. And maybe this is what might work now, but I'm beginning to think the other side is so damn well organized that anything less won't work. But anyway, I just want to get off the air and hear this discussion. What do you think about this before I hang up?
Okay, well, I think what happened in Richmond was both a surprise to me, because I'm a very dark-thinking person, but also a triumph. But I think it was so obvious. If you went through that area just a few years ago, you could smell the refineries. It was a poisonous environment, and what essentially had always been a company town for the oil industry was turned around to a great extent. Now, other factors were involved, one of which was that San Francisco and Berkeley became too expensive to live in, so Richmond became, you know, that whole area became more desirable, more housing was built, and so on. There were a lot of demographic factors. However, you're absolutely right. An organized effort turned things around and was a great surprise to a lot of people, including the petroleum industry. Thanks for the call, man.
Hey, thank you, Joe.
Bye-bye. Okay. Gene? Oh, Jane.
That's fine.
Sorry.
I just wanted to say that I do see a lot of under-reporting from pretty much everybody. And it's not possible to know everything, but for example, we talk about political parties, political power in the South, Grand Gulf, Mississippi. This was considered the worst case of environmental racism within our country by the NAACP. Actually sued. They didn't want to do nuclear power plant. And yet Entergy, which is a $10 billion a year company, they are a big company, they are co-partners with Toshiba Westinghouse. Now, there's no mention of Japanese corporations. It's heavily underreported. Toshiba Westinghouse, they actually crashed and burned not too long ago at the beginning of the year. It's an Enron deal in Japan. Heads are rolling. They're getting sued. Their government is PO'd, and we kind of did mess with them. If I was a fan of nuclear energy, I'm not. I would feel sorry for the Japanese, personally, because America bleeped them. But these are complicated relationships that we have. And I'm sorry to make this side note. I know it's offline, but they have, by the way, Japan is having sightings of the rise of neo-Nazis in Japan. There are kids wearing SS uniforms in Japan, and some of this has to do with 9/11 and what they call 3/11, which is Fukushima. There are people who are saying conspiracy theories, and I've seen them because I speak Japanese, that Israel has somehow backed the bombing, or that the America drilled into the seabeds of Fukushima and detonated a nuclear bomb, and that's 3/11.
Wow, I didn't know the conspiracy theorists were that, fake science-based.
You know what? My family's mixed race, and my family enlisted before 9/11, and so I watched this stuff, and I've lived in Japan. I was friends with one of the main war activists from Okinawa when I lived in Japan. He grew up in the war zone. And I think of these things because they're so complex. Japan has a unique relationship with America, and it's so just not talked about. You know, Steve Wynn, the head of the RNC, his best friend is a Japanese billionaire who's under FBI investigation right now. There's no mention on the evening news. It's all J-Lo and who's dating Drake. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I'm really glad you brought in the Japanese question. I was appalled to realize that a lot of anti-Semitic literature and a lot of racist literature in Japan had become popular and had become part of the general discourse. And that's still been true. Japan was and led in directly into an imperialist war, making a lot of racist assumptions about the inherent superiority of the Japanese people, as you no doubt know. And that led to the enormous, of course it was an imperial system, but that led to the enormous foolishness on the part of government of Japan in the case of joining with Hitler and Mussolini in World War II.
I would like to say this because I have Japanese friends. It is not everybody. This is shocking to me because I have friends from Japan who they have nothing to do. Even they would be like, what are you talking about? And many people, I've seen one of the conspiracy theorists who is, I think, American, I'm not quite sure what he is, but he's somehow affiliated with UCLA. The press corps that he was speaking to was laughing at him. They thought he was crazy. So just on behalf of Japanese citizens, it is not everybody.
Oh, but, no, I didn't mean to imply that it was.
No, but I mean, it's very confusing because they are so, they have been traditionally a closed society. That is something that people study, and it's important to understand that they have Kaibatsu is Japanese corporations, which Chris Hedges doesn't talk about. This is Sumitomo. Sumitomo Mitsui Trust Holdings did purchase parts of holdings of energy, ETE, which is the mothership for ETP Energy. They own everything. They are the owners of Summit Discovery Resources, which is with Rex Energies. Those are the people doing the shale mining and Make America Great in Pennsylvania. And I've seen the people on the Japanese press corps talking about the Make America Great and Trumponomics, and they're talking about it in Japan. They're watching us. And the guy that just did, let me just, before I leave, talk about the guy who stabbed the people on the bus. That guy was mentally ill, and he's probably has a brain injury because he was shot in the face. I would like to also say this. These people like him, they are sometimes drug addicts and part of our prison system that needs to be figured out, because we recruit our white supremacists straight from our prisons, and this is something that we may have to really take a deep look at our prison system. I'm sorry to, like, mash all of this together into an issue.
No, that's okay. It's an interesting perspective that we don't get that often, so I appreciate it.
So, thank you.
Thanks for the call very much. I think that, you know, when we start talking about what's wrong, it is an endless, unfortunately, an endless dialogue or monologue, and it is certainly the case that the prison system in this country is basically for the poor, and it's basically for persons of color, and it's basically a system that doesn't deal with mental illness in any effective or anything less than cruel way. It is very sad and very stupid and has the longest prison sentences. We have the largest number of prisoners. All this kind of stuff is very real. And I just wanted to give a kind of an affirmation of that problem. I also believe, I don't want to get into a long discussion about this, obviously psychotic, murderous, racist, hate criminal who did the stabbings on the MAX train. I have a lot of thoughts about exactly what one should do in those circumstances. And what happened was, while very brave, not the best strategy. But I really don't want to talk about that because, first of all, it's too new. And second of all, there needs to be more real serious follow-up about the alternative right, alt-right, and all that other stuff. All that's real. All of that has the potential to be very, very damaging and harmful and hurtful. But let's stick with the question now. I'm going to use Lenin here. What is to be done? Give us a call, 231-8187. Mike.
One thing we can do that's fundamental, grassroots, individual, is bear witness. Okay.
What do you mean?
We all have cell phones with, well, we don't all. We have cell phones. We have cameras. We have cameras in the cell phones with
us.
Yeah,
right.
Anytime you see obvious nationalist, racist, Trumpian in their trucks, jacked up, they've co-opted the U.S. flag, which is a damn shame. They don't even need to fly the Confederate flag anymore, even though it's just the Virginia flag. they can just fly the U.S. flag, and everybody knows what they're about. They've got the "Don't Tread on Me" stickers on the trucks. They've got the racist things on the truck. They got the "We don't care, we'll run over them with our truck" things. There's guys provocatively running around with weapons and all those stickers and stuff. And they have the tinted windows. So anyway, they're a bunch of cowards. Anyway, they're afraid of something. I don't know why they're afraid of it, but I can imagine.
Well, they're hurting. I think one of the things that's really important is to understand how the constant patriotic drumbeat and the constant distortion of the situation. For example, that the coal miners who lost most of their jobs, not because of any political decision about environmentalism, but because mountaintop removal was so much cheaper and they could get rid of so many workers and save more money. All of that is distorted and not really analyzed.
So the consequence is someone bore witness to something that is real or not real, right?
Right.
Let's call it Trumpism, right? And guess what? That got attention. All these racists and stuff are coming out of the woodwork proudly, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's my point. So we can do the same thing by bearing witness. We have these phones. Take pictures of people's trucks and license plates and them if you can, but do it safely. You don't need to be provocative. You can even wave at him and say, hi, thank you for showing us who you are, where you are, what you are, when you are, how you are. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
And send those electronic media to the SouthernPovertyLawCenter.org or the authorities. Give them a database. Because cops, even if they could, I don't think they can take a bunch of pictures unless the FBI or something's involved with the investigation, which of course they are. But now, with Trump's in there, they'll probably do away with the racist investigations on militias and stuff. So what I'm saying is, we can do this all day, every day. I live in Clark County, Vancouver. Look at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I'm telling you, I drive around town every day because I work all around town. These, you know, they're a vast minority, but they are a hotbed for the Ku Klux Klan here in Carr County.
Okay, listen, I agree with you.
Throw it out there, get it out there, send it to all the authorities, send it to all the human rights organizations, and also, well, hell, send it to the right-wing organizations. Say, hey, we know who you are. We know what you're about. Get back under your rock.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, man. I really appreciate it. I think the strategy of confronting evil is good, but it is by itself not enough. I also think that it's really a difficult problem to not heighten the rage and revenge need of people who are ill-educated and who are hurting and who have lost their incomes or have income reductions or lost their jobs. This is really an environment that's rife for fascist conclusion and racist conclusion. And I appreciate your suggestions. I think it's a good idea, but maybe not a crucial one. I think what really, again, is crucial is organizing the dumb, dreary, everyday work of organizing and instructing and talking with people and putting out literature and making clear what is going on. You know, with the media, and this is really important, the media, particularly television media and radio, and since there's not much of a newspaper left here, except I have to praise the Tribune and others, Willamette Week and Mercury and so on. The fact of the matter is that we are not being educated or informed adequately by our media. And we are, all of us, seeking in the media business something that will work both for the advertisers and for our audience. And that compromise has led to a horrible distortion of facts. And I would add to that what I learned in grade school and high school about American history was not just a white, literally, wash, but a gross distortion without the acknowledgement of the horrors that went into making this country. And we have to understand who we are as a nation, and we have to understand the challenges we face as a nation, and not distort that into some kind of magnificent patriotic magic with God on our side. So let's go on to the next caller, 231-8187. Who do we got? L-E-V, Lev. Oh, Lev. Hi, Lev.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Pretty good. Haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't have a whole lot to add here. I think in terms of resistance, I think everything you're saying is right about organizing, running for office, and doing all of that, people being diligent on the Internet. It's funny how the Internet has kind of, you know, the democracy and openness of it has kind of backfired in a way for democracy. And I think that's something, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges when you talk about things like fake news. But the only thing I had to add, and again, I think the crux of most of it does come down to organizing and face-to-face conversations with people to get, you know, people really committed and to know that they, that you're on each other's side and you're connected. But I was just, I just started this book kind of randomly called The Burglary. And it was about the folks that broke into an FBI office in, I think it was in New Jersey, and, you know, exposed J. Edgar Hoover's whole spying.
Is that, right? I'm trying to remember, is that the Catonville 7 or something like that?
Yeah, like the this book came out a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, nobody knew him for like 30 years or 40 years. The book is what revealed most of their identities.
Uh-huh.
But what it was is it kind of came out of this one particular activist who was, you know, he was a committed nonviolent activist against the Vietnam War, and along with like Catholic priest, he started doing the thing where people were breaking into draft offices.
Right, and the people I remember most were the Berrigans and several others, but yes.
Right, and then so that same guy had this idea, you know, he just felt like a lot of activists at the time felt like the FBI, for some reason, seemed to know a lot about what's going on. He was pretty determined to prove that Hoover was spying on Americans and that it was illegal and it was a huge program. And he, you know, said, well, they're probably keeping all their records in all the different offices, knowing how the FBI keeps their records.
Uh-huh.
Let's break into this office and see what they have, you know. And then that's eventually what, you know, revealed all the things Hoover was doing and the political repression that was happening through the FBI and the government. But what just struck me was just kind of the creativeness of it and the focused thing of kind of taking, you know, nonviolence, not just like being a nonviolent protester on the street, but then this act of burglary it's a crime, but it was a nonviolent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just encouraging people, you know, in addition to the very important, you know, nuts and bolts of organizing and running for office, is, you know, maybe we can start thinking a little more creatively. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of leaking going on, and ever since Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, like this whole, you know, of these kinds of things, and that's happening. So I'm not necessarily talking about a leaking kind of thing or a break-in, but let's think of creative ways of resistance.
Well, I think that's a very important aspect. I think creative activity in the arts is a great opportunity, and public art. I, for example, think that sometimes helping the homeless would involve trespass, and that certainly is not something legal. I am very concerned about a lot of these things, but I want to mention one thing that you referred to, which is the role of the FBI. The COINTEL program, which I was a partial victim of, was a program to discredit primarily black nationalist groups, but later and almost at the same time, all of the anti-war groups. It means,
right.
And that was a big program of the FBI, and it was really outrageous, and it went on for a long, long time. So, yeah, you're raising some really good points. And there are times when it seems like, for example, if you're marching for something, and they say you can't do that, well, then you're in a situation where you may have to commit civil disobedience.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Joe.
Thank
Important
you very much for the call, man. Take care. 231-8187. Mimi, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for the show. So, first of all, we have real, true, and blue Nazi cops, you know, on the Portland police force. And we know that, the mayor knows that, and they're still receiving paychecks. We also know that Chief Marshman, was supposed to watch a very specific, it was a computer app, to understand how the computer app worked, which was to inform him and the mayor and anybody who was admin in the police force as to who our criminal cops are. And what Marshman did in that moment of having to, by the DOJ order, having to watch that app and learn how it works, he had his right-hand guy forge his signature so that he didn't have to go and watch this, you know, learn how this computer program works in order to weed out our criminal cops our cops who are Nazis, you know, and so on. And we have such racism in our police force. It's based on racism. The police force came out of slavery, and yet we talk about things like organizing. What is the what's the point of organizing? I understand organizing. I'm an organizer. But until we deal with the reality of what's going on in Portland with our mayor allowing Nazi cops to protect people like Christian at the protest last month, they circled him. They allowed him to do his hate speech. They allowed him to bring that bat in. They asked him, hey, can we hold that bat for you? Like they're going to give him the bat back while he's saying he's going to kill anyone who gets in his way. This is the problem that needs to be dealt with immediately. Our police force targets Black and brown people and houseless people in our city, and we allow that to happen. And when we protest against it, what happens then? Those same police, under the orders of our mayor, come after us with the riot patrol, targeting Black leaders in our city with the LRAD unit, and we don't talk about that.
What's the LRAD unit? Help me here.
LRAD unit. It's a military. It's a military vehicle that can.
Oh, is that the one where the cops all hang on the side?
It is. It also has the. It can deafen you. It can block. It can do a lot of things. It's like I said. It's a military unit. It's multi-purpose. It can create blasts that you can't hear on the outside, but that can deafen you. So it's crowd control. It can. It has a huge loudspeaker on it as well to get their message out, which they used months ago at a rally right after Trump to go after Teresa Raiford and told her that they were hunting her down on the street. This is our police force doing that. And we protest against that so that we can protect our Black and brown community from the police, who have known Nazis on the police force, and we don't talk about that. They need to be fired. That's what needs to happen right now.
I agree with you to a tremendous extent. I have to plead a little bit of ignorance. I'm getting to the age and stage where I cannot jump into every struggle. And I, while I feel guilty, I also feel old. But you're making a very good set of points. I know that there are, and because I've known several of them, some very good and reasonable police, but they always have, when they've ever talked openly with me, expressed concern about the police department and how it's run and who is there and who wants to be a police person. And this is an issue. And I'm really glad you brought this up.
And I also want to address something that you said a few minutes ago, which is that you aren't sure if it's the right tactic to get in between, let's just say, a Klan person, a Nazi, you know, alt-right person, and somebody who they are attacking. I have to disagree with you. I think that it's our responsibility, especially as white people, to protect everybody we can possibly protect with our privilege. Sometimes it might not work out in our favor. And that was clear, that was evident in this act of love that these three men took part in to protect what was right to protect. And that needs to continue to happen. We need to put ourselves, those of us who can, and I think there are many, all of my friends would have done the same thing. I would have done the same thing. The reason that this is also so intense for so many of us, especially among activists in the activist community, of which I am a member, well, not really a member, a person, any one of us would have done that. And we're seeing the heightened reality of what the Nazis and the Klan members are willing to do. And when we allow, again, back to the same issue, when we allow Nazis like Kruger, like Marshman on our police force, and we don't get rid of them, this creates the okay for these people to continue to do the same thing. When Ted Wheeler went to their protest, their rally last month, and he gave them free bus passes to leave after the rally, free bus passes for TriMet. Who uses TriMet more often than others? People of color, people who don't have cars, and you're putting people of color in direct vicinity of Klan members who now have a free pass that they were given from the mayor.
I don't know enough of what you said. I don't
it's
doubt
all,
that.
Well,
let me finish.
Everywhere.
I don't doubt the truth of it. I only say that I am not adequately informed to respond. But I appreciate what you're saying, and I don't doubt the truth of it. I just don't know. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Let me confess something at this point. I am not at the center of political action today. All kinds of reasons for that, but I'm not. I am definitely supportive of these efforts, and I think it's very important to reveal the sources and the power relations that take place. I also am pretty much convinced that we must exhibit our humanity, even our vulnerability, in the face of this fascist movement. The other thing I want to bring out is that when you elect a Trump and you put the ruling class directly in the situation of openly operating the whole government, you open the doors to the most fascist and the most racist and the most sexist elements of the general community. You legitimize this. And that's why Trump is more terrible than he would be as a single element in a single centralized political system. Hey, I've run out of time. I've enjoyed this show a lot. I really encourage all of you to call us. Arguing is good. Disagreeing is good. Being respectful is good. It's a good idea to participate at every level in restructuring, rebuilding, and correcting the horrors that exist today. Thank you very much for the calls.
From those nads in Tiananmen Square, it's coming from the field.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 10 o'clock, it's Chris Andre, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Law & Disorder investigates Trump's financial ties to Russian oligarchs, plus former CIA analyst Ray McGovern explains the deep state's role in hacking during the presidential campaign. At 11 on Stage and Studio, D'Mae Roberts welcomes Devin Allen, who stars in a new production of Good With People at Performance Workshops Northwest. Then a preview of D'Mae's new documentary, Crossing East, Relations, about the historic relationship between Black and Asian Americans. And at 11:30, On the Ground, voices of resistance from the nation's capital with reports from Gerald Horn on the Manchester bombing, Libya, and the Supreme Court's ruling voting rights decision. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And please stay tuned for Alternative Radio. Camille Paglia speaks on Free Women, Free Men, a look at different currents and tendencies within the feminist movement.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. This year, the festival will be held June 30th through July 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 5-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the